Can you mute the PA real quick?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you
this
could take your seats.
This is the ICANN 47 contracting process for new GTLD applications recording.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, if you could take your seat, we'll be getting started with our next session, contracting process for new GTLD applications. Okay, I think we're ready to get started here. Krista, go ahead.
Thanks, Dennis. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Krista Papik, and I'm the GTLD Registry Services Director. I have with me Cyrus Namazi, who's Vice President of Domain Name or DNS Industry Relations, and Christine Willette, who is our Vice President of GTLD Operations. Today we're going to talk about the contracting process for new GTLD applicants. I'm sure some of you were in the earlier session, the new GTLD update session, where we did actually cover some of these things, but we of course have a session dedicated to this now. So we had our we kicked off the contracting process a few weeks ago, on June 13th with a webinar, and we took those of you who may have attended the webinar took you through the contracting process and the different things to expect during contracting. Because that's the first time that we actually have discussed contracting and the process in detail with the community, we thought we would review that again today, as well as providing you with updates that have occurred since the webinar. So contracting milestones and status. Here's where we are today. On July 3rd, the registry agreement was approved by the ICANN board. Also on July 3rd, we sent out contracting notifications or invitations to contracting for priority numbers 1 through 50. 31 of the 50 were invited to begin the contracting phase. Applicants are invited to begin the contracting phase based on their eligibility. So there were 31 that were eligible based on various milestones that we published, but things like having passed evaluation, not currently in contention, no outstanding objections, items like that. On July 15th, or as of today, July 15th, we've received, let me just take one step back. Those contracting invitations include something called a contracting information request, which is basically a request for information that we need in order to create your registry agreement. Of the 31 that we sent out on July 3rd, we've received 4 responses to date, and all 4 of those signed contracts over the past couple days, or you would have seen at the opening ceremony this morning. Thanks. As I said, we signed 4 registry agreements this morning at the opening ceremony. We signed an agreement with International Domain Registry Party, or PTY LTD. it was for an IDN string, which is the Arabic word for web or network. We signed one with Core Association, which was the Cyrillic word for online. We also signed one with, again, with Core Association for the Cyrillic version for website. And we signed a registry agreement with Springfields LLC, and their string was the IDN for Chinese word for game. So the contracting process, and these are the slides that some of you may have already seen. We've updated them to reflect changes that have occurred since the webinar. The first slide that we have here basically takes you through a high-level overview of the process. So at the very highest level, ICANN determines eligibility, so which applicants can be invited into the contracting process. Once we make that determination, we send out the contracting information request. And again, that's the document that, or the communication that we use to gather all of the required information that we need to create a registry agreement. Once we receive the contracting information request back and it's complete, or it contains everything we need, we would then create a draft of the registry agreement and send that out to applicants to be signed. Once the registry agreement is signed by both parties, ICANN and the applicant, we submit, would push that applicant through to the pre-delegation testing or PDT process, and we would initiate other processes like posting the agreement and things like that. This slide is just meant to really graphically represent, the high-level process. As you can see, we've got the balls in the funnel going in, which are the applications. Again, those are based on their eligibility at the time, which is, again, you've passed evaluation. There's no pending objections, contention, change requests, or GAC advice. Those eligibility notifications, or those that are eligible, receive the contracting information request, and once we get the information back, they proceed through actual contracting, which is, you know, drafting the registry agreement and getting it signed. So the contracting information request, or CIR, those are sent out in priority order and based on eligibility. We send out the CIRs to the primary contact, and it's the primary contact who has to respond to the CIR. All of these contracting information requests are initiated by through the customer portal. And all of the response and contact also goes through the customer portal. Once we have the CIR back with all of the relevant information, if no changes are being requested, and that's changes to the base language in the registry agreement, the applicant would be eligible for signing. If they are requesting changes, they would go down a negotiation path with ICANN. One of the things in the contracting information request that we ask for is a contracting point of contact. So the CIR has to be completed by the primary contact, but all communications and discussions about the contract and getting it through the contracting process would then be taken over by whoever you want to appoint as your contracting point of contact. And finally, when we get to signing the agreement, currently applicants that are eligible, that complete the CIR in full and send it back to us and are, and want to proceed with signing the agreement, are also will also need to sign a supplement to the registry agreement. The reason we're doing this is pending resolution of certain issues that are yet to be resolved by the community, such as some of the outstanding GAC advice, some of the RPM requirements, and things like the PIC DRP. And what the supplement does is it temporarily enables ICANN to update the executed registry agreements, again, pending the resolution of these outstanding items. Next slide. So the contracting information request. The CIR has basically 10 things that it asks for. The goal of the CIR, as I said, is to collect all of the information that we need in order to create a registry agreement for you. One of the things that we did right after the June 13th, or shortly after the June 13th webinar, is we posted something called a CIR guidance document. It's basically a document to help you understand what the pieces are, how you can pull them together, and it's really meant to enable you to start collecting this information now in advance of receiving your invitation to contracting. So for those of you who want to move as quickly as possible through the contracting process, you can essentially gather the information now and have it ready to go as soon as you receive your invitation to contracting. So So I was going to drill down into the 9 different elements of the contracting information request. Slide 15. You can go one more or two more. Next. Perfect. So the first thing that's asked for is your points of contact. So again, contracting process, contact. Who's going to engage with ICANN to talk about the contract and get it signed and go through all of that? Who's actually going to sign the agreement? And who's the legal notices contact? So every contract that you enter into, you always appoint a person who receives legal notices that relate to that contract, and that's what the legal notices contact would be. Exhibit A to the registry agreement, which is basically your registry services, the portion of your agreement that outlines the services you're going to provide. Exhibit A will include DNS service TL zone, DNS service TLD zone contents per the applicant guidebook, and additional services, if any, per your application. So, with respect to the DNS service TLD zone contents, the AGB specifies certain things that can be in the zone. Any other zone contents would have to be approved through an RSTEP process, and so your Exhibit A will include language to address this. Secondly, with additional services, any other services that you described in your application, additional services that you want to provide would also need would also be included in your Exhibit A. Examples of additional services would be things like second-level IDN registrations, searchable whois, or some sort of additional RPMs you might have provided for in the application. Continued operations instrument. The COI, or continued operations instrument, that you need for your registry agreement needs to contain the details that are outlined in Specification 8 of the registry agreement. We know that people have had a lot of questions with about LOCs, and so in the webinar, the June 13th webinar, we committed to doing an initiating a LOC outreach program. We began that on July 5th and have been reaching out to applicants to try and get ahead of their CIR requests. Obviously, the initial phase. We can't get ahead of something that just started, but we're continuing to send out letters to applicants whose LOCs appear to be deficient or not meet the requirements of Spec 8. If your LOC is acceptable, you will not receive an outreach letter. The most common issues that we've noted from our outreach is inadequate duration, so the length or the term or the expiry date, if you will, of your LOC, and LOCs that are not unconditional. Changes to application data. So you're required to, if anything in your application has changed, you're required become untrue or inaccurate, you're required to, the applicant needs to submit a change request. Change requests do need to undergo a 30-day comment period, all change requests, and applications may not proceed to the next step until that 30-day comment period has elapsed. It's possible that some change requests will require reevaluation. And for those of you, most of you probably are familiar with this, but we have a change request process, which is also posted on our microsite, new GTLD microsite. Cross-ownership relationships. Per section 5.1, applicants need to provide, 5.1 of the guidebook, applicants need to provide a statement of cross-ownership if applicable. Cross-ownership means if you have an interest in a registrar or reseller, and any interest that a registrar or reseller has in you. You submit your cross-ownership statement with your CIR package. The CIR guidance that we posted on the microsite contains a sample cross-ownership statement that you can download and just put your data in there and be done with it. The statement includes things such as ownership type, relationship, accreditation, contact information. Specification 9, Code of Conduct Exemption Requests. So applicants can request an exemption from the Code of Conduct if all the domains they intend to register are registered to the registry operator for its exclusive use. The registry operator doesn't sell or transfer use of any of the registrations to a non-affiliate, and the application of the Code of Conduct isn't necessary to protect the public interest. We've had a lot of questions about about the Code of Conduct exemption requests. And when we talked about this on the webinar, we received questions as to what that exemption request should look like, what does it need to contain. And at the time, we were still awaiting, we needed some information, or we needed the board NGPC to respond to the GAC advice. We now have enough information from the board on the response to the GAC's Beijing communique that we can adequately address the code of conduct exemption request. So we have a draft process and a draft sample statement that is currently being reviewed within ICANN and that we intend to post as soon as it finishes the review process. That will also be posted on the contracting page of the microsite. Special considerations. So there's two types of special considerations. There are applicants who are an IGO or governmental entity, and basically they need to submit to us documentation of that designation. All of that documentation needs to be on official letterhead. There are also community applicants who have applied for submitted community applications. They will have a specification 12 to the registry agreement, which outlines their community registration policies, and those policies must match what's in the application. The specification 12 will be developed jointly with ICANN. If an applicant is both an IGO or governmental entity as well as a community applicant, then they would need to provide both of the items discussed above on this slide. So changes to the registry agreement. Per Module 5 of the Applicant Guidebook, applicants are expected to enter into the registry agreement substantially as it's written. Applicants may request and negotiate terms by exception. applicants who do request to negotiate terms will take substantially longer to complete the contracting process. Just to be clear, and I think we might have even gotten a question about part of this in the earlier session, changes to the LOC, the things like the Exhibit A, Spec 12, and Specification 11, those are not considered negotiation path, if you will, changes. Electronic signature. So the CIR will ask if you wish to use electronic signature. We have implemented electronic signature through a vendor called DocuSign, and we actually use DocuSign for two of the four agreements that we signed. But, of course, traditional signing, whether it's wet signatures, faxing, what have you, scanned email type of things, will still be available for those applicants wishing to use them. So next steps and additional information. So next steps for ICANN. As I said earlier, we sent the first 50 CIR notices out on July 3rd. We will be sending notices for priority numbers 51 through 108 beginning on July 24th. We didn't want to send them out before then because we're in the middle of an ICANN meeting and we have received feedback previously that people don't like to receive requests for lots of information or lots of work during an ICANN meeting. Subsequently, we will release CIRs at 40 per week until our pipeline is full. So when we send these requests out, 51 through 108, not every one of those applicants will be eligible to be invited to contracting. The ones that are will be invited to contracting, and we're, as Christine said earlier, endeavoring to send notices, though, to all of those applicants, letting them know if they're eligible or not, and why not if they're not. We want to throttle up the pipeline as quickly as possible so that we can start getting these responses back and pushing them through. And so, again, I think you talked about this a little bit earlier, Christine, but we would send them out at 40 a week. We could potentially, a minimum of 40 a week, we could potentially send out more. But once the pipeline's full, we may need to throttle back just a little bit until we can kind of get to a steady state. One other thing I want to mention is that the customer service portal where this contracting process is facilitated through, we'll be publishing a user guide also that will walk you through the CIR process and how it works inside of the portal. Other next steps for ICANN, our initial goal is to sign at least 20 contracts per week. Our standard contracting path, so no negotiation, is a 2 to 3 week turnaround time, and those that elect to enter into negotiation, the timing's going to depend completely on the negotiation and response times also from the applicant themselves. So next steps for applicants. If you haven't already done so, I would encourage you to access the CIR guidance on our microsite and begin collecting the documents that you need to complete your CIR or CIRs if you are have applied for multiple strings. I would also encourage you to check your COI against Specification 8 requirements. Another thing that we've posted on the contracting page of the microsite with the guidance is a sample LOC to hopefully help you see, the type of language we're looking for and term and or duration and things like that. Other next steps for applicants. If you have a change request that you have been meaning to submit but haven't, I would encourage you to do that now as well. And then I would encourage people to watch for posted updates on the contracting page of the microsite. And then lastly, one of the things you'll be asked for during PDT is data escrow. It's for your data escrow contract to be signed, and I think there's a certificate that you have to provide. I would encourage you to get a head start on that now so that when you do get to the PDT PDT process, you don't hold up your ability to progress through PDT because you haven't contracted with an approved data escrow agent yet. And then this slide just provides some links, which I'm sure are not very easy to see from back there, but when you down, you, these slides will be posted and you can access this information, and it'll these links can take you to the various parts of our microsite where you can obtain all of the information I just discussed. And with that, we'll take questions.
Yes.
Hi, Amadeo.
Okay, I was waiting for the green light. Before you get the questions, you will get something else with congratulations. I am impressed. Last time I negotiated an agreement, either a renewal or a new agreement with ICANN, it took 7 months, and this is not my personal record. My personal record is more than double that. This time it took 10 days. Four was because of there was the long July 4 weekend in the United States, and two because it was we made some mistakes on our side. So it took you 4 days. Impressive.
Amadeo, I think this is the first time you've said something positive about ICANN.
No,
just for the record.
No. Before you arrived, I was saying lots of positive things. Oh, sorry. Sorry. I had to retort to that somehow. No, the question is, I have some questions and some suggestions. Everything comes, very well prepared and very simple to fill. It really takes 1.5 hours to fill the CR form and all the documents. But, for instance, regarding the LOC, you are saying that that you are reaching to the people regarding what happens. But I would have a suggestion that you explain there. It seems the logical reading of your explanation is that you need a documentary COI. And as you know, in many countries, only Swift Message LOC exists these days. So we only have a collection of printouts of Swift messages. The answer we got, and this is why we talk for 5 days to complete it, is that there is no problem with that. But perhaps you should clarify this, because we got a lot of questions from our customers while in reading your microsite, that it seems that you need a documentary signed by the bank, etc. And this doesn't exist in Switzerland or many other European countries anymore. The second one regarding the LOC is the address of ICANN. You moved. It says there you have to have all these elements, and one of the elements is ICANN is in Waterfront, but many of the LOCs you got, you were still in Admiralty Way. Please explain whether we need to amend that, or whether it's recommended, as we got as an answer, or whether we shouldn't bother just amending the COI for this concrete issue. Now, on the questions. We get all the agreement pre-form, all the registry services are there, all the PICs are there. And for the communities, I guess that we will also get the specification 12 pre-filled by ICANN. And what I got is that, in fact, you are taking question 20E, where the policies were specified, eligibility, name selection there. I have a suggestion and a request. There is something that's important to also be there. It's the definition of community. Because most of the cases, this is in Q20A normally. And all the policies just say eligible people are members of the community, but if we only take Q20AE, in most cases you will not have a definition of the community. It sounds very strange. And the concrete question is, if we want something like adding the definition of the community, I understand that this is not asking for contractual negotiations, right?
Thank you, Amadeo. To answer your question, yes, that's correct. I just wanted to also comment on something you said about us moving, because I want to maybe clarify something. So we did move. If the only thing in your LOC that's incorrect or inaccurate is our address, we will accept that LOC. We only ask you if you need to update your LOC anyway, we will ask you to update the address as well. Thank you. Where'd Wendy go? Do you want to? Okay, Carol. we're gonna rotate between the questions online and the queue here in the room.
Hi, this is Carol. The first question is from Maxim Alzoba. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce very well. What is the reason for the new requirements for the COI?
Thanks, Maxim. The requirements for the COI are not new. They've been in the guide, in the registry agreement for some time. Jeff Newman.
Hi, Krista. Welcome. It's good to see you on that side of the table. Not that it's not good to see the rest of you. It's always a pleasure to see the rest of you. Just a couple, hopefully some quick questions. On the slide, if you can go back to the slide where you said the process, actually you don't have to go to the slide. You said it takes about 2 to 3 weeks. Is that from the time you send out, the time you receive the completed CIR or the time... or measured from something else?
From the time we received the completed CIR.
Okay, good.
Sorry, can I just add one thing to that, which is sure. All of the timelines that we're quoting here, we've taken Christine's lead and it takes 2 to 3 weeks at the maximum would be what we want to do. We're aiming to do better than that, but we want to set expectations appropriately.
Okay. And I know we've talked about this, but it would be good to clarify for everyone. You said you're going to do 40 a week until pipeline is filled. Does that mean you'll take 40 a week, and once your pipeline's filled, you're going to stop for a while? Or does it mean you're going to take 40 a week, and then if you could take more, you'll take more?
It's the latter. We want to fill the pipeline. We would continue to send out 40 a week, although if we all of a sudden get an onslaught of responses because we've sent out, say, 500 of these things and we get 100 back, we would throttle back the pipeline to allow us to work through the responses we received, and then we would throttle it back up. One of the concerns, I think this has come up before, one of the concerns is if we send out all CIR requests at one time, we get the data back, that data is going to get stale. And then we have to come back to you, and that doesn't seem very efficient. So we want to have enough in the pipeline to keep us busy, and we're counting on you guys to help with that. but we don't want it to be so full that, again, stuff starts stagnating in there.
Right, and just to follow up with that, is it going to be a specific day of the week that we're going to send out on this day every week? Or, I'm just trying to see what predictability there's going to be.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So we intend to send CIRs out on Wednesdays in the U.S. Pacific time. And if we're sitting around twiddling our thumbs, which I've yet to see happen in my 7 weeks at ICANN, but if we're sitting around twiddling our thumbs, we would certainly, send out more CIRs before the next Wednesday if that seemed to make sense.
Okay. My last question is on the code of conduct exemption request. I know you said that there's going to be a form or a statement that will be posted, which I think is helpful. Can you just go into, or can someone go into, what your criteria will be to determine whether a request for exemption is in the public interest, or I should say is granting it is not against the public interest, or whatever the criteria is, or whatever it says. Can you just go over what your thinking is as to how you're going to evaluate that, what steps you're going to take? Is it just you put it out there for public comment and then people, what I'm worried about here is I'm worried you put it out for comment. A lot of people, maybe competitors to brands, put out all these comments because they don't want them to get an exemption, or registrars put out a bunch of comments because they want to, provide registrations in the TLD. So can you just go over a little bit of what your thinking is as to that third element of the request or the exemption?
So you know this. Until we finalize what we're putting out, we need to get that finalized first. So unfortunately, I personally don't have a lot of information on that one. And second of all, it looks like Dan maybe wants to... No, okay. That's the, yeah. And then the second thing I would just say is that we're going to post, it's guidance that we're going to post. So it's implementation, it's guidance that we're going to post that will explain to you what the process is for requesting it and give you a sample that you can use to draft your own request or,
Sure, and that's why I'm asking the question. It's not, the process is great and you'll show a draft statement, presumably, for those that were requested. But what you're not telling me is when and how you're going to develop the criteria to accept that request or reject that request. The first two elements are pretty simple, right? That's a self-certification, and that's in line with the application. But how are we going to know as advising our customers as .Neustar, because I will be requesting that. How will I know, how will I advise my CEO that my request will not be denied because of the third element?
Again, we're still developing that. So as soon as we have something, we'll get it out. And it's a high priority. Everything's a high priority.
Is this something we should engage in, if there's time, engage in a discussion with the community? Because I don't see that as something as a one-way, a top-down, ICANN's going to decide this is the way it's in the public interest and this is the way it's not. I think that's more of a community dialogue as to think about that particular issue, I would think.
So thank you, Jeff. I think that's a great idea. I think we do need to actually consult with the community on that particular segment of it so that we don't inadvertently actually put you at a disadvantage competitively when we do that. So we'll have that dialogue with you and the community. Thank you for the input. Yeah, that's great input.
Thanks, Jeff. Carol?
So the next question in the queue was from Ingrid. Is there a deadline for the applicant to submit the completed CIR after the invitation by ICANN?
No, there's no deadline. But the responses, just to reiterate something Christine said earlier, the responses are we put them into the next phase of the contracting queue, if you will, in the order that we receive them back.
This is Dan from Legal. Just a slight asterisk on that. Right now there's no deadline, but maybe at some point we've talked about, there is in the guidebook, it specifies there's a certain end time. You can't just sit on your approval forever, but we're not currently starting the clock on that due to other issues and other stuff that's not settled, like the supplement, the GAC advice.
It's just on the, when you said that you're going to do them as they come in, just say you don't want to talk to me and I'll sit back down.
Adrian, it's just not fair if we go in front of other people. You can get to the back of the queue. Thanks.
It's my turn?
Yeah, go ahead, Pam. Sorry.
Hi, Pam Little, representing Zodiac. Zodiac has applied for multiple strings. My question relating to the COI, letter of credit. The letters of credit, 15 of them are all of identical terms. We really appreciate the outreach effort. I think they're called notification. So we have 5 of those. And some of them, the trouble we have is that they're inconsistent. They seem to be sent by different evaluators or initiator. Some of the notification raised 2 questions. Some raised 3 questions. And some with the same question but different language is required. We also have 3 invitations for contracting to have those COI open issue, but 1 we didn't receive the COI notification. So we're a bit confused as how to address them. So we think some consistency will be helpful in terms of how you evaluate those COIs and also the requests or the action items. Otherwise, you know, we have to go to the banker, and every time we're giving them different instructions or different requests. Thanks.
So this is Kevin from the Legal Department, and I'm the one writing all of them. So the issue is we're going off what we have in our files, and they're not always I don't think our files always represent the most current. I think some things are maybe lost in, you know, in transit, or just not loaded properly. So ultimately, it's your document itself that governs. So if you note any inconsistencies in the letter that you received, disregard it. And we did get this email from you, and we did respond. Hopefully, it'll probably go out today or as we're speaking here. And I have other letters drafted for you guys, and we corrected that issue. And we've seen that you've made the correction. So again, it's ultimately your LOC that it governs, not the letter. So I would not worry too much about it, and just as long as you meet the requirements, it's not an issue.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Sure. Thanks for that clarification.
Just a quick reminder, please, yes, just like you're doing, hold the mic in your hand and speak right into it because of the remote participants are having a hard time hearing if you don't do that. Thank you.
Hi, Jay Westerdahl. So I don't know if we can get the slides back up, but I had a question.
Which slide?
It was the slide regarding registry use of names, like reserving names. Let's see here. I don't know. There wasn't slide numbers, so.
Are you talking about the Exhibit A?
Yeah. Maybe.
This one here?
No. Keep going. There was three sections to it. There we go. Yeah, go back. Okay, no, you're still going. Go back. Yes. Okay, here we are. Okay, so all domains are registered to the registry operator for its own exclusive use. So my question there was, so we basically reserve some names. At what point in the future, because I see the second bullet point, the registry operator does not sell. If we have an inquiry in 2 years, 5 years, whatever, on one of these names, what's the process we go about if we wanted to actually open that up and sell it?
So this is about Specification 9, Code of Conduct Exemption Request, right? So this is about the whole registry is exclusive use. Can you maybe just re-ask your question?
Let's say I register register.mytld, right? And we set that up basically to, serve as a registrar in our space. At some point, let's say that registrar gets outsourced and it's being run and it's doing well. And we say, okay, we want to jettison that name, that whole business unit. How do we get around this point two?
Jay, it's Dan. So are you asking how to get rid of the exemption once you've got it? Or you want to amend your agreement? I'm not understanding the...
So if I have a reserve list of names.
So Jay, it's not about reserve list of names. It's your whole registry is only names registered to you. So this is, no one else is registering domain names in the registry. Only you are. And so I think the clarifying question we're trying to say, are you saying you want to go from being a registry that only registers names for yourself to being one that registers?
This is a brand specific one.
We don't have a brand designation, but yes.
Okay, that's it.
Okay.
All right.
Never mind. Okay, good. Do we have any more questions online? Carol?
Hi, the next one was from Yasmin. Question, will specifying additional services in Exhibit A require the applicant to automatically proceed to RCEP, and must an applicant indicate the changes have been made to its application?
Actually, can you read it? Just read it again.
Sure. Will specifying additional services in Exhibit A require the applicant to automatically proceed to RCEP, and must an applicant doing so indicate that changes have been made to its application?
So if I understand the question correctly, if an applicant has applied for additional non-customary registry services and in their application, and they've been successfully gone through evaluation and they're approved for those registry services, then they are eligible to include those registry services in the Exhibit A.
Correct.
if the applicant will not be eligible to put any additional registry services in the Exhibit A at the point of contracting. After they have a signed registry agreement, they may initiate an RSAP to request approval to provide additional registry services after contracting.
Jim Prendergast.
Hello, Krista. Jim Prendergast, Galway Strategy Group. Question about the outreach that you're going to be doing ahead of time on the COIs. You said that you're only going to be notifying people if they have an issue, but since you were able to score a 3 in the evaluation and still may have an issue, will you be telling the community at what pace you've reached? Like, we've already reached out to the first 500, so if you're below 500 and you haven't heard from us, you're good. There needs to be, I would recommend there needs to be, you know, okay, great, they've passed me, I don't have to worry, you're not going to come back to me on this.
Yeah, no, that's a great suggestion, and we will do that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. No. Carol?
Sorry, we skipped one person, Michael Fleming, so we're going back in the queue. And his question is, I believe this may have been stated earlier in a previous meeting. However, for clarification purposes, is it possible to receive clarification for when pipeline will be full concerning CIRs?
So the pipeline being full is going to be based on how many people respond. Is that the question, Wendy? Can we communicate, or it's about communication? Like, how do we know the pipeline's full? Yeah. No, we can absolutely do that.
Rubinsky.
Sorry, just to be clear, yeah means yes. Go ahead. Yes, Rubens. Go ahead.
Rubinsky. I know your answer to Jeff's question on code of conduct exception, but just need to ask if a string is listed on the GAC advice on closed generics, do you think that does create a strong presumption that such strings shouldn't be granted exception to the code of conduct?
Sorry, can you just ask that last part again?
consider a string that was listed in the GAC Beijing communique under exclusive use, that they listed generic strings that they think shouldn't be run in a closed manner. Do you think that creates a presumption that ICANN shouldn't grant those strings an exception to the code of conduct, provided they apply for that?
So, yeah, we can't. I don't think we can presume anything at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Do we have another question online?
The next one is for KOM. Question, are the objection panels processing objections based on a prioritization draw? If they aren't, it can affect contracting and help some applicants market advantage by filing the objection alone, regardless of the outcome.
So this is Christine Willett. So the dispute resolution service providers are processing all objections simultaneously. Based on the sequence of when the objection came in and the specific timing as for each objection and when it was verified and moved forward in the process. The objection process is all happening simultaneously. It's not, there's no queue for it to be based on priority order.
Jordan.
Hi. A question and a suggestion. First, the question is, am I hearing correctly? If you've received a CIR and you haven't heard anything about your LOC, then your LOC is probably okay, or does that we or we the, don't hear anything until we respond back with the CIR with the information about the LOC?
You're correct. The first way you said it is correct. So if you've received a CIR and you have not received an LOC outreach letter, then your LOC is acceptable.
Great. So my comment is, I think it strikes me that there are, it seems like there's a number of bottlenecks in the contracting process that are too small right now. Like, our goal, I think, is to have 20 TLDs being delegated into the route per week, because that's the scaling limit that we've all agreed as a community is, you know, we don't want to break the route, right? So we want to have no more than 20 TLDs going into the route per week. But I think we also, I think I've heard in the past saying we want to actually have 20 TLDs going into the route per week. So almost every step previous to delegation needs to have a lot more than 20 per week going through it in order to enable that to happen, at least until you get up into steady state. And your CIR process is super demonstrative of this, right? You thought, oh, we can do 50, and that will, you know, then we'll be doing 20 a week eventually. And in reality, you sent out 50. Well, you went through 50 numbers. You sent out 31, so we lost 20 right there, right, because there are various people not eligible. You got 4 responses back. Right? And so now, even though you've gone through 50 numbers, you've only used 20% of your capacity at that stage in the week, and we never get that week back. That week is lost, right? so we need to, I think I really strongly encourage you, like you said, that if you send out CIRs to everyone right now, the information may get stale. I think you could just tell applicants, if your information comes out of date, make sure you update us, you know, prior to contracting. You could just have, like, everyone could just send in their contracting information right now, and you could work through in sequence. At the very least, when you're debating whether the pipeline gets full or not, you should make sure you have at least a week's worth of contracting buffer in place, because that will also solve Adrian's problem that he was going to come down and talk about. Because if you're doing things in priority order and you have at least a week's worth of buffer built up, then there's no advantage or disadvantage based on when you receive the when you receive and are able to respond to the CIR. You'll do everything in priority order. But similarly, you're talking about doing 20 contracts a week. That's not enough. Some people are going to fail PDT. Some people aren't going to be ready for PDT after they do the contract. Some people will fail TMCH testing, won't be able to go through that process, right? Like, there's all sorts of places further down. And so I think until you're delegating 20 a week, everything should be whatever is the maximum you can operationally do right up until the point that you get to the 20 per week that you're sending to IANA. And at that point, you can stop, right? You have a break there that allows you to throttle the process at that point.
So just a couple clarifications. So our goal is to sign a minimum of 20 contracts per week. That's the first point. Second point is we've just kicked off the process, so we're doing it the same way we've done other processes that we've kicked off, where we are starting off slow, making sure we have all the pieces, it works, people are getting what they need, that we got the right process in place, et cetera, and then we want to throttle up. So, you know, absolutely the goal is not to have only 20 going through to PDT, because you're right, some of them might be challenged in PDT or might have issues, or they may not want to schedule PDT right away or what have you. So absolutely we have thought of all these things, but we also don't want to, you know, throw out, you know, 1,000 of these things, have a bunch of stale data sitting there, and create that creates additional bottlenecks downstream. And so, and we want to, again, make sure that the process is working. And I would just want to stress what I said. The goal is a minimum of 20 contracts a week.
Sure. I guess my point is please be careful to make those throttles as wide open as possible. Because like I said, we're not that week. Like some week there's going to ideally be 4 names going into the route, and we'll never get that week back. Everyone else is backlogged behind them because we didn't get enough CIR. I mean, not enough people responded to their CIRs the first week that we sent them out.
Yeah, absolutely. And sorry, just one more thing, and then I know Christine wants to add something to this. We also have no way of knowing how quickly those come back, right? So we actually expected to get a lot more than 4. But it's like everything else. You know, nobody really knows how many applications would there be. Who knows? So absolutely. Christine?
So absolutely. We have modeled many different scenarios. So I, too, am a fan of bringing as many into the pipeline as possible to move forward. However, we are also trying to balance that with respecting prioritization. So there's a fine line there. Do we want to move things into the contracting process and move forward while still continuing to respect prioritization? I do anticipate that we will reach a point in a few weeks, I don't think it will take months, at which everyone understands the necessity and value of responding to the CIR quickly. So I think that we will get to a point where we are issuing 20, 30, 40 CIRs per week, and we're getting them responded to. And that is, we are, I will commit to you, that's my team managing that and administratively collecting, sending those out and receiving them back in. We will do that at our capacity, for sure.
Sure. I'll make one very short last comment to just say, honoring prioritization is important. It almost doesn't matter. Like, as soon as the pipeline gets full and you're delegating 20 a week, it really doesn't matter if there's prioritization earlier in the process because you can do it at delegation time, right? Like, just sort things that are ready, allow them to delegate in priority order, and that solves the entire problem.
Thanks. Question online.
Hi, the next one is from Maxim. How many legal advisors are at your disposal for non-standard contractual negotiation? It will help us to estimate our timing. Then the second part of that, it says the 300K cap was forgotten for a COI.
Lots.
Is this more than one?
There's six of them sitting actually in this room, and many more back in California and other places. So hopefully the staffing on the legal side is not going to be a bottleneck for any of the things that we're trying to do. And we also have, of course, Jones Day, who's been our partner in this process, with many of their firm's attorneys on standby, ready to kick in when necessary.
Reg Levy, Minds and Machines. I have two requests and one question, and the requests have to do with the webinar and the question pod that disappears. I understand that you didn't like the public comment pod, but it would be nice if we could see all of the questions that other people have submitted, because it appears as though questions get lost in the train between my computer and your computers. So if the entire community can see the questions, then accountability is held to better. My other request is that you trade off and on between the calls on the phone and the questions in the question pod, also on your webinars as we're doing here today. My question refers to the 30-day comment period for change requests and whether or not that applies to private parts of the application, because if it does not, is there a 30-day delay just sort of for fun? And if it is, are you posting for comment some sort of redacted version of the confidential parts of our application?
So the all change requests are subject to the 30-day comment period. And Christine's probably better to answer this. I know that my understanding is that if it's one of the confidential or the private parts or the non-public portions of the application, the way that the comment period goes is there was a change to, you know, section blah blah blah. Is it redacted or
if it is a change to a confidential question, that change is not posted, but it is noted on
and
the application.
And there's a comment period about whether or not the applicant is allowed to change something that nobody knows about.
So the comment period isn't about can they change it. The comment period is to notify everyone that something has changed.
Okay.
If you wouldn't have known what the answer was to begin with, so if some confidential portion, financial reports, et cetera, had changed, it wouldn't have been subject to an application comment.
Okay.
I will address the webinar questions. Mm-hmm. So suggestions. Thank you for the suggestions. We will certainly take it into consideration. We are working to make the webinars run as smoothly as possible. We have, although it's never not as quick as I would like, we have for the last three or four webinars now published Q&As. So any outstanding questions that were not answered in this session. They get summarized. They're not everything. There are many repetitive questions, mm-hmm. so they may get grouped together, but they are answered in a Q&A document, and it's posted. We try to get them posted within 2 weeks of the webinar. We haven't been very good about that.
Okay. Where is that posted? Because that question that you just answered, thank you for answering it, I asked at the last webinar, and I've been asking routinely, weekly, in fact, for an answer.
So, yes, you've emailed me. And so your question, you had another question that got lost. Mm-hmm. It was not submitted into the queue. So I forwarded that. It got added to the Q&A, right. And that's been posted to the microsite. It was posted a week or two ago.
Do you know where on the microsite?
On the webinar page.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Question from the queue. Will the addendums and attachments that come with the contract be posted to review?
The attachments and
Addendums and attachments that come with the contract, will those be posted to review? Supplement, I think, maybe.
So the question that was asked is, yes, we are going to post the contracts and the supplement that we're entering right now. That's in the process of being posted right now. Amadeo just asked another question, though, about the supplement, the cross-ownership statement. I don't think we have a plan to publish that. We're not planning to publish the CIR responses, in other words.
Hi.
Anthony
Vancouvering, Minds and Machines. Perhaps this will be dealt with in the next session on post-delegation, pre-delegation testing. But since we're talking about contract changes and so on, the applications were submitted, I believe, 15 months ago. I suspect that there are very few applicants who haven't made some kind of change to their technical infrastructure in the intervening time, whether it's getting an upgrade to their load balancer, adding one, changing IP addresses, any number of things. To what extent do we need to notify ICANN about these? And it's a concern because it could engender quite a bit of delay, and I don't want to inform people about things they don't want to know about, particularly, that are rather trivial. On the other hand, we have undertaken to inform ICANN about any changes, and we heard at the last pre-delegation testing meeting that the guys from NIC SE are going to compare exactly what's in your application to exactly what you have in terms of your technical infrastructure. So I'm trying to understand what we need to inform you of and when we should inform you about it.
Thanks, Anthony. I know we talked about this in Beijing, so I will reiterate what I said then. I do think we could discuss it further in the pre-delegation testing session, which starts in 12 minutes. Any time an application becomes inaccurate or untrue, the applicant is expected and required to notify ICANN of that via a change request. So that is still what is in the guidebook. I recognize that that is challenging, and we should discuss it further, the exact details of what is tested versus vis-a-vis what is in the application on a technical level. So let's talk about it more.
Can I just one follow-up from what Reg asked? If there is a change to part of the application that's not public and that is noted, mm-hmm. are you still holding that up for 30 days because of that notification, even though there's no possibility of response because what can you respond to?
We are following the same process at the present time, regardless of what portion of the application has been changed. We are still following the same 30-day notice. So we are 3 minutes past due. I think maybe we need to let the other session set up. Can we take just a few more questions very quickly?
My name is Usman. Sorry. I am Usman Dovda, a private participant from Nigeria. My question is on the issue of public interest. Some countries have a law subjecting every other rule or agreement to public interest and public policy. In view of this and the exceptions made here, don't you think the provision of code of conduct is not necessary to protect public interest as said here, which is one of the exceptions superfluous?
So if I understand you, you're saying that the exception to the code of conduct should not relate to the public interest. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. What I'm saying is some countries have laws making provision for public interest and public policy as being superior to every other rule or agreement. And here we are told that applicants have the option to request for exception if the application of the code of conduct is not necessary to protect the public interest. So since it's provided by the municipal law, is it necessary for the code of conduct to be included? That's it.
This is Dan from ICANN staff. I think the way we have the specification 9 set up is consistent with what you're saying, that if it is necessary in the public interest, we will require compliance with the code of conduct, even though those other two factors are met. So it sounds consistent with what you're saying. The trouble is, as others have asked, well, what does that mean exactly? And that's where we find ourselves trying to sort that out. So maybe you could help us explain or understand how it's done there. But anyway, it sounds like the way we're doing it is consistent with what you're asking.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Liz Finberg, PIR. I wondered if you could just, and I know we're short on time, but I wondered about the interrelationship of additional services under Exhibit A and the RCEP process required for that and a change request. In other words, if a registry or if an applicant wanted to add services, would they do it through a change request or in advance of contracting or must – how do those things interrelate?
Sure. So obviously that it's up to the applicant. Mm-hmm. But the way that we've set up the program and the contracting process, et cetera, is you can provide the services that you were evaluated for, mm-hmm. and those go into your Exhibit A. Mm-hmm. If you want to do something more than that, mm-hmm. you can do one of two things. You can submit a change request and go through the 30-day comment period, et cetera, or you can go through the contracting process and then contact us that you want to add a service and then go through the RCEP process. So it's really up to you to evaluate what makes the most sense for you at that time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Liz.
Krista, if I may just add to that. In order to move through the process most quickly, if a change request is submitted after you have received your initial evaluation results and you've been evaluated for a certain set of registry services, that change would likely require re-evaluation or evaluation in a future round, at which point possibly extended evaluation, you know, or re-evaluation during the extended evaluation phase. So unless it's something that you feel strongly about having in place at the point at which you sign the registry agreement, I think that the most expeditious process would be to move forward with your Exhibit A stating what you have already applied for and then initiating the RCEP after contracting. Thank you.
Yeah, John Berryhill, my question is a continuation of that theme. When you talk about, you know, the application having been evaluated, is it safe to assume that registry services described within the application were evaluated such that, you know, if we pass that section and then provide, you know, Exhibit A consistent with the registry services that were in the application, that we can safely assume that we might treat as a presumption that, you know, to the extent that Exhibit A is consistent with the registry services that were evaluated in the application and passed, that that would be non-controversial. The flip side of that is if we do not provide an Exhibit A that describes registry services that vary from the standard that were evaluated and passed, is that problematic? To what extent, I guess, Dana, is I was assuming that, you know, what you say in the application more or less merges into the contract. Is that a valid high-level view of the process?
So I don't think it's necessarily safe to assume that anything you put in the application that passed the evaluation is necessarily going to be okay to go straight into the contract. In most cases, that probably will be the case. But the evaluation we did on the services during the evaluation process was basically a technical evaluation purely. Would this service break the internet? And so as we build the Exhibit A's, we'll look at them again, though, more carefully, because there might be other issues like compliance with other parts of the contract or policy issues, or is this consistent with the way we do invoicing, or just other kinds of practical and policy things that weren't part of, you know, do you pass what was basically a technical evaluation.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Rob Hall.
Thank you. I've got a question about a different contract. So, and since this is the contracting one, I thought I'd stand up and ask. This morning, I had the privilege of signing the registrar accreditation agreement, and I saw people sign the registry agreement. No one's talking about the other one, the RRA, the registry registrar agreement. And as you can imagine, as a registrar, we're starting to see a lot of these now from new DTLD registries. And there's things in them that I believe should not be, and go a long way, I think, to, you know, breaking the structure set up by ICANN. So there's lots of oversight over the RA and the RAA, and almost none that I can tell over the registrar agreements. I believe ICANN has in their provisions that they get to review any changes down the road to those, but not the initial ones. So perhaps you can give us 30 seconds or a minute on what is the process of the oversight ICANN's having over these, because I think a lot of people are incorporating things they couldn't get into the RA or the RAA into those agreements.
Rob, it's Dan. So you're right. The process that we have for RRAs is similar to the process we've had for years. I'm trying to think how far back it goes. Maybe 12 years for sponsored agreements, which is that the registry, when it starts up, can sign up registrars with whatever RRA it wants, as long as it's consistent with all the other requirements of the registry agreement, which there are requirements in the registry agreement about what must be in the RRA. So if there's a compliance concern, we can take that on, and we can look at a few specific concerns that a registry isn't complying with its registry agreement in terms of what's in the RRA or not in the RRA. But in general, registries, because we you know, looked into this, it would be very difficult to impose a one-size-fits-all RRA across 1,000 different registries. So registries can set up whatever RRA they want in the first place, as long as it's consistent with their obligations. Once they have registrars and registrants signed up, if the registry wants to change the RRA, then it has to go to ICANN for review. And we have a procedure for RRA changes that we've used for years on those. So if anyone has specific concerns about a registry allegedly having an improper RRA, we could look at that. But there is no process for ICANN review or approval of the initial RRA as so a general matter.
Do you see it even, or is it just no? Okay.
No.
Is there any provision for making sure they're the same amongst all registrars for a given registry? Because I know we've got GTLDs out there now that have different RRAs for different registrars.
So I don't want to get in. There are requirements. I think in one of the requirements, I don't want to say off. It's not memorized yet. The new registry agreement, but one of the requirements does talk about having I believe it's the same RRA with all your registrars.
Okay. Perfect.
With an asterisk, I'm not 100%
so
sure
it's
about
a
that.
Compliance issue when we
it
see
be,
one that concerns
bring it to
us,
our attention.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So thanks, Rob. So we're way over on time, and the next session starts in 2 minutes. And we still have 10 questions online. So I just wanted to, I know, Amadeo, if you have a quick question, and then I wanted to also let the folks that did submit questions online know that we have your questions, and we will respond to them, you know, and put them out or whatever so that they'll get addressed. So, Amadeo, quickly, please.
Sorry, I have a question that is sent to ICANN Legal, but I was told that should be sent to customer support, but I don't have an answer yet. The question is regarding the language of the error rates and the registration policies. In the old days, they had to be at least in English. But now, for instance, for IDNs, et cetera, is this assumption valid that the error rate and the registration policy and dispute resolution policies should be at least in English so all the community may understand that and done in the languages you want? Or can be just directly in Russian or in Arabic and nothing else? Because now this question is pressing for some of the registries. I don't know.
Yeah,
I know have a position, but I don't know yours.
Sure. I know the registry agreement is in English. I don't know about the other ones. Maybe Dan...
I would just say that I remember seeing this question, and I think we were discussing it, and we'll endeavor to get an answer to you quick and okay. Get out information about that.
And I hate to do that. It's the very last one. I promise to do it. Cyrus, is ACROM available for public signings, ceremonies with champagne photographers and all that jazz in Los Angeles?
You can ask him yourself. He's sitting right there.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks very much. So pre-delegation testing in 2 minutes.